We've been working with Finn. We've been working through the seven domains.
There are seven domains.
Of permaculture, which is a framework created by David Holmgren, one of the founders of permaculture.
Yep.
And
most commonly known as the permaculture flower.
Yeah, and it is represented with seven petals as the seven domains. And today's one is land tenure and community governance.
Yeah.
And what does that mean?
Yeah, so that's... kind of distilling it down, it's about ecological ways to provide access to land and to govern our communities. And so it's thinking about... So the land tenure part is about how do we manage land? How do we manage a landscape? And, you know, the history of Homo sapiens over the last, 300,000 years has been kind of mixed in that space. And the more...
Certainly the last 10,000 has been pretty radical.
Yep, absolutely. And so it's an exploration, I guess, of what does that look like from an ecological lens. And then the community governance is how do we make decisions? You know, I think we've come to our default position is that, what we call democracy, representative democracy, is the only way that decisions get made or is the true form of governance. And so I guess this is an exploration to kind of scratch the surface a bit deeper and go, well, how do communities make decisions and how do they make good decisions and wise decisions? And what are the things we need to think about moving forward instead of relying on large centralized decision-making to manage local resources?
Mm. Yeah. And we've found there's been times like when COVID escaped Auckland and got here, we found that local decision making was way more important. There were a few big important things decided by the central government, but actually just solving day-to-day problems for life of people in our community while that was happening, it all had to be made locally.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so bottom up, I mean, that's how decisions have always been made through human history is essentially, you know, generally speaking, it is bottom up. It's from kind of whānau, then out to kind of, I guess, extended families, neighborhoods, communities, and up. And, you know, and it's not to say, you know, we don't have a history of top-down decision-making as well, but the important day-to-day decisions are generally made as families, as communities.
Yeah, and we've just gone through a period of looking at who's going to be making our top-down decisions, and we still don't entirely know the answer to that question this morning. But we can get a little bit, we get so focused on that, and sometimes that can make us feel powerless.
Mm-hmm.
But in actual fact, there's a lot of day-to-day decisions and community decisions that we have to make.
Yeah.
And it's really important not to bring that sense of powerlessness to that, because we actually do have much more say over what happens in our community.
And I guess this isn't necessarily where I wanted to go with the conversation, but just to draw a comparison or a way of framing that might be helpful is, you know, when I think of representative democracy, i.e. our current national governance system, is that is, you know, I get a vote to say who's going to make decisions for me.
Yeah.
Whereas I think an equally important, if not more important, way of thinking about active democracy is participatory democracy. You know, I'm actively involved in decisions that get made. And there's a scaling issue with that. I understand why we have representative democracy, because when you have 5 million decision makers, things get unwieldy. But when we're looking at a much smaller scale, much more localized decision making, I question the role of representative democracy more and more. And I think participatory democracy is, I guess, where the democratic process arose from.
And it's actually much more feasible now with technology.
Hmm.
We actually all could vote. Hmm. As long as we've got access to online, which is not totally universal, but we actually all could vote issues.
And so that's an important distinction, eh? Not vote for who we're going to delegate decision-making to, but vote on specific issues and contribute towards actual decision-making.
Yeah, you could actually take the politics out of it. Just what is the best thing to do here? Anyway, like you say, we don't want to get sidetracked. Land tenure, what does that phrase mean?
Yeah, so land tenure is about...
I think there's a lot in there.
There is. So it's about essentially how land gets occupied and managed. And it doesn't have to be both, because, you know, this thing called the commons that Garrett Hardin made into this kind of almost cuss word in the 1960s. And for listeners who aren't familiar, Garrett Hardin in 1968 published a very famous paper called The Tragedy of the Commons. And I don't know too much about the man, but he was almost certainly what I would call a social Darwinist. He certainly believed in the view that humans can't be trusted because we're all about self-interest and it's a dog-eat-dog world and all of that. He, because I found this interesting, one of the quotes in his publication, The Tragedy of Commons, and you get a sense of the worldview of this person.
Yeah.
Ruin is the destination toward which all men rush, each pursuing his own best interest. And so, of course, in The Tragedy of the Commons, he talks about why the commons don't work, why they'll never work. And his conclusion to that is you need either total privatization or total state control. And while it might seem a little bit ludicrous, that idea has been so prevalent. It's one of the most cited research papers ever. And it's still a very strongly held belief that that the commons don't work.
If I could diagnose, I think I'd diagnose a fair degree of trauma in his life and projection of his approach, the strategies he developed to cope with his trauma, projection of those strategies onto the rest of the world.
And I don't know enough about
that. And I've been rude about deliberately, but I do think that is he sees the world in a certain way, and he can't see anything else. He can't see like when babies are born. That he would say we have to knock them into shape and get them, show them how to behave properly. But I'm quite sure likely. You know from your kids when they're little, they do lots of acts of kindness and care unprompted.
Yep. And the opposite too, you know?
Yeah, well, they're learning, and they're also learning from us, and we're imperfect beings. So, that sort of thing winds me up a little bit because like you say, it's quite a prevalent attitude and it's used to justify a lot of things. I don't think it... If you go and do the research, I don't think it's supported by the research.
Oh, well, it's not. I mean, so what I find interesting about that is almost in diametrically opposite ways to, say, the Limits of Growth report, which was published 4 years later, the 1972 Club of Rome report, Limits to Growth. That was probably the most critiqued piece of science arguably ever published, and it still holds true today. Like, every updated version of it using advanced computer modeling, the best we have today, shows that they pretty much nailed it. And yet that's been critiqued. Whereas on the other side of that, you have Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, which has been pulled apart and ripped apart and ripped to shreds in terms of just the lack of credibility it has. He made up a whole bunch of data where he didn't have, so he just assumed things. To support his argument when he didn't actually have the evidence.
Because
for
he was so sure he was right.
Yeah, and he just reflected the values of the time, right? Because that was, I mean, we still live in a neoliberal economic system which has all the same beliefs about
it. Yeah, and the word values there is the key there of why it survived, is because it appeals to people with those values.
Yeah, that's
And it's convenient. But anyway,
so
I'll pull my opinion back out of this.
I guess just to, again, because I think it is important to frame this conversation, because otherwise I think it's a non-starter, because people go, oh, well, Tragedy of Commons, why are we talking about land tenure anyway and community governance? We know it doesn't work. So there was a woman, almost she was a contemporary of Harding's, named Eleanor Ostrom, an amazing woman, but she's basically spent her entire career looking at why the commons, or exploring why it is that the commons do so consistently work.
Yeah.
And so she's been all around the world and looking at a whole range of very unique, creative, and actually quite practical ways in which human communities organize themselves to manage shared resources. And she's come up with a series of principles that I thought might be interesting just to share. What a successful commons, or what communities that successfully manage shared resources do fairly predictably, is they define who is doing the managing. So they're clear on who those agents in the system are and who has roles and responsibilities around managing those shared resources. Those resources are reliably monitored so that they have good real-time information about where things are at, state of play. There's a reasonable balance of the costs and the benefits for those people participating. So it's not overly arduous to enforce or manage. You know, there's a balance there. This one, which seems like possibly the hardest, particularly in today's world with our existing governance structures, but is clear, understood, fast, and fair conflict resolution. So people are know what the process is to resolve challenges, and it doesn't take months and months to resolve. There's a means by which this conflict can be resolved fairly quickly so that a decision can be made and the system doesn't break down. There's escalating punishment for cheaters. So the scavengers and the predators in the system are disincentivized from gaming the system. And then lastly is good relationships are maintained between the community and other layers of authority, knowing that, you know, often within the sharing of the commons, you have multiple layers of authority. So an example in our current context would be, you know, we've got Waikato Regional Council, we've got Waikato District Council, as well as maybe community groups who have interest or ownership.
We've got a community board.
That's right.
Yeah, which is a subset of Waikato District. Yeah.
And then you might have ownership boundaries of certain land parcels. And so all of that is, you know, all of those people are kind of informed, and there's good relationships maintained across all of that.
So what commons do we have now? What are the commons in our modern world?
Well, so our parks and reserves, our coastlines are really kind of classic examples. But then we have things like community gardens, community orchards, forest gardens, those kind of resources as well. But then we have kind of informal commons, so like the patches of bamboo around, or the repo, or some of the streams that might have watercress in them, or any number of these public or private spaces with resources that are desirable. I would argue that in some ways, extreme zero waste is a form of the commons. And so the commons look different today. I mean, in a more traditional context here, Mahinga Kai would probably be one of the most key concepts in terms of, you know, those sites of cultural harvest, whether that was fiber or food or medicine, you know, or other things potentially, is there'd be potentially even, you know, seed stock and things like that.
So these are things that operate as commons, like the bamboo. You ring the farmer up and say, can I come and get some bamboo? And they're like, yes, please, take as much as you can take.
Yeah. And so, and again, that's an important thing there, is there's a relationship there. So it's not just necessarily showing up and jumping the fence. And, you know, so there is a managed relationship there. And my understanding of Mahinga Kai is, you know, there were a whole bunch of culturally understood protocols around how those resources were accessed, who needed to be in communication with who, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there are lots of kind of unique examples of the commons. And if we peel that back and we're not just talking about things like food, fiber, fuel, or medicine, then we also have things like playgrounds and libraries, and, you know, arguably all of those are part of our commons today as well.
There was a time on this land when it feels like everything was commons. Well, the concept of private land, I should say, it'd be more accurate to say the concept of private land ownership didn't really exist, which has led to all sorts of problems, of course, the introduction of that concept. What does permaculture have a vision for how we would manage our land tenure?
I feel a little bit of pressure to answer on behalf of permaculture, but the,
all permaculture everywhere.
So I guess there is, you know, a few writers, permaculturists who weigh in on this space, and I guess I think what would be safe to say is a permaculture response, or at least inquiry, might be, well, how would nature do it? And so there is a default to ecological ways of doing things. And
so there might be some, rather than saying it would look like this model, there might be some principles that you draw from from the ecological perspective.
And generally speaking, I think a very good start is looking at the indigenous peoples of place to see how they've organized themselves around land tenure and community governance, because almost certainly, those have been tried, true, and tested methods, you know, where they've learned what works and what doesn't work. They stop doing or tweak the things that aren't working or aren't working as well as they want, and they replicate the things that do work.
And these are, you would look at the people who have not destroyed the local ecosystem. have not destroyed their land base.
Yeah, I reckon, yes, those people would not typically, well, I don't know, maybe this is contentious to say, but would not necessarily be considered indigenous. They haven't stuck around and learned how to live wisely in place.
Yeah. Oh, so you're saying that there are people who were...
Well, I think there's a... So humans throughout time, since we've been moving, have moved through a range of landscapes, and sometimes human populations have decimated a landscape and as a result of that moved on to the next one and keep recurring behaving in kind of predictable ways. But often human populations will realize that what they're doing isn't working and stay where they are, and then through that process of staying, learn how to live in place in an ecologically responsive way.
And an actual sustainable way. Sustainability is a word that's bandied around a lot today. Mm. But there were indigenous, usually Stone Age cultures, I think, yep. who were able to do that, a genuinely sustainable lifestyle without bringing in energy imports, and without any waste that had to go somewhere and be a problem for somewhere else.
That's it, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. Something that we struggle with.
So a thought that I just had is Rahui is quite an interesting concept when thinking about land tenure and community governance.
Yeah.
You know, so it had, I guess, both of those. It was a community's way of agreeing to manage or interact with land in a particular way for a particular period of time that was different from how it was normally interacted with.
What's your definition of Rahui?
So a cultural, what's the word, prohibition of access or use of particular areas or resources.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the most common thing is when someone's died in the water here.
Yeah.
Yeah, there'll be a Rahui on the water for a period of time.
Yeah. And so I would imagine, you know, that is, again, a community governance. There's a decision or a rule that's been laid down that lasts for a period of time that basically says what you can and can't do in certain places. So I think it still fits that description.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never really thought about that before, but there's, I guess, a cultural expression from this place of how communities would make decisions about what's appropriate to do in a particular place.
Yeah. So, and how is the decision made? Like, that's the community governance, but how was the decision made?
Yeah. So moving into that space is, there's quite a few models out there. And I guess there's the decision making, and then there's the community processes that might lead to decision making or figuring out what's important to focus on. And they're parallel, but they're not always the same thing. And so in the decision-making space, we have things like consensus minus one, colored cards, co-governance. There's a whole range of, I guess majority is probably what we're most familiar with is as a voting system. There's ranking. There's any number of ways in which communities can collectively make decisions. And they all have kind of value implications. You know, what's that expression is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others, and
yeah.
You know, which is a slower, more cumbersome process. And so things like consensus take time. You know, that they absolutely take time. And I think they're also problematic when dealing with the Western individual psyche in terms of, you know, that tendency to think that our decision or our opinion is more important than everyone else's. And so consensus can fall over really quickly when you have someone who really wants to make a point of being positional about something, not necessarily because it's in the best interests of the community or the people who are sitting around the table making a decision, but because they're precious about their position or their opinion.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking of like this organization and another one I've been involved with are overseen by committees where it's where the decision making is by vote.
Yep.
But I don't remember ever voting except on one occasion.
Yep.
When and that led to a disaster.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
But normally everyone is on board with that. They know what the organization's about and why they're here.
Yep.
And can everybody hear the vacuum cleaner in the background? It's not too bad. It'll sound really loud to you, but less loud to the listeners. So in practice, our tendency is not to go for a vote.
No.
Our tendency, and especially like in our families, we try to, well, it depends on the family, I guess, but consensus decision making is actually something we do quite naturally and informally.
Yep, I would agree with that. And I think things like councils, general assemblies, are not too dissimilar processes. You know, what I like about the co-housing color card system is they identify two key components to any kind of group decision. And one of them is talking about the issues, understanding different perspectives, pros and cons, etc. And then there's the actual decision making. And so there's this whole time dedicated to ensuring that all perspectives that are required are understood.
So this is co-housing, like eco-villages and what have you?
Yeah, not all of them use it, but I know, for example, Ursong up in West Auckland and Rānui.
Yeah.
And it is fairly common in the co-housing movement specifically. Less eco-villages, but more co-housing, is they use the coloured cards, and it's got this interesting whakapapa. It comes from, a religious fraternity. It comes from European Christianity. I believe a bunch of nuns kind of figuring, well, how do we make fair and equitable choices? It's a great method. Colored cards. I've seen it used in.
So how does it work? There are several colors, I presume.
Yeah, and each color represents different things. But it might be a little bit abstract for listeners. But basically, you have the set of colored cards. When you get them, you're taught how to use them, and then you have a facilitator for all, I guess, community meetings in which they're used. But the colors change meaning depending on whether you're discussing or whether you're kind of quote unquote casting a vote, you know. And again, they're very clear they're not voting, but when you're stating your support for a given idea or decision or not.
Yeah.
And what's great about it is they rank things like opinion versus emotional disturbance versus
strength of feeling. And so have you participated in this process?
I have, yeah.
Find it?
It's great, yeah. I mean...
Like in terms of getting a resolution that people could... That would stick.
Yeah, well, it takes a maturity. And I think that's one of the interesting things is that land tenure and community governance require a certain maturity that, cynically, I would say, Western individualism has undermined.
I would I'd say accurately.
Yeah, well, and you know, I don't want to be dismissive or sound overly paternal either in terms of, you know, in theory, we're all adults, we're all mature, but I've been in enough community spaces to know that there is a tendency for people to feel the right to espouse their views ad nauseum without actually...
what's this bringing up for you right now?
Even professionally, it's a space that I'm very familiar with.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I know that there is a tendency for people who've been raised in countries that I think maybe overemphasize the individual, that getting to a place of what's best for the community is more challenging than maybe it is for people who've been raised in more communal cultures.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Okay, so we're sort of near the end of the show. We've been talking land tenure and community governance, which is one of the domains, one of the petals for the permaculture flower that David Holmgren has created. Land tenure, community governance. How do you wrap that up, and why does a thing that started off as about gardening, I'm being slightly perjured of here, why did people who do gardening think they have anything to say about this?
Yeah, well, so I guess... From my mind, again, coming back to something we've said before, is this idea of the permaculture flower is about stepping back and going, okay, if we actually want to think about sustainable culture, if we want to think about resilient communities, we need to think of a whole range of things that fall way outside of just pure food production. But as an example, if we ground it back in this land or pretty much any other, food production has never really been an individual activity. It's very rarely even been a family activity. It's been a community activity.
Yeah, yeah.
And so having clear understanding about how land is used and to what ends and who makes decisions about what's happening on the land has, you know, that's imprinted in our DNA. You know, that goes way back to the Neolithic. So we've been having these conversations in some form for at least 10,000 years. And as we move forward, again through that lens of energy, and energy being the master of all living systems, is in an energy constraint future where we're not going to be able to delegate decision making out to some centralized authority again, or it's unlikely. And the flip side of that is, nor will we probably want to. You know, increasingly, I think people are realizing the benefit in being able to make decisions in smaller groups. And so we need a degree of maturity and the tools and processes to allow us to have meaningful interactions that allow us to make decisions together and allow us to make wise choices about how we manage shared resources. You know, I'm involved in conversations now about growing kumara with several other families, in part because many of us are too busy to all put down a large bed together. There's also a recognition that it's more efficient to grow a larger bed with more people.
And it's more fun.
Yeah.
At the moment, individual gardenings, that only introverts are going to want to do that.
Yeah.
It's like people who actually enjoy being by themselves, otherwise gardening gets very boring. In fact, even people who are introverts still actually do want some company.
Yeah, that's it. Eh? And so there's a whole bunch of things that just make sense to manage collectively, and then there's a whole bunch of things that just need to be managed collectively. And again, delegating out to a federal government or a regional government or a district government doesn't necessarily always make sense, and often I'd say it doesn't.
Yeah, and I've seen, like, because I follow what happens with our council and our community board here, and it's really, really clear to me that every decision that can be made locally should be made locally, because it's a better decision. Because it's not to insult people over the hill at the council. They just don't know as much about our place as we do.
Well, and they're not as invested in the outcomes either.
Yeah, of course. You know? Yeah. It's very common sense thought, really. It's like, just, yeah, it just makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, one of the reasons I focused on Hardin's The Tragedy of the Commons is that's such a stopper. Often is people go, oh, it doesn't work. Remember Garrett Hardin's The Tragedy of the Commons. And I just
want to... Well, they have that insult decision by committee. A committee always makes a bad decision. Yeah. Whereas that's probably a dysfunctional committee made a bad decision with one person dominating it and everyone going along with them.
That's it, eh?
Yeah. All right, Finn, thank you for coming in.